KALW. From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from the East Bay, from Concord.
Fruitvale, East Oakland.
I'm from Milpitas.
Berkeley.
Palo Alto.
I live in North Beach.
Coming up, Bay Area residents consider the anniversary of the Armenian Genocide.
And you get people saying like, oh, 100 years, it does not matter. That 100 years ago was yesterday.
We'll hear how young Armenian Americans experience the legacy today.
You feel like you have to state your case to everybody, like you're accused of something.
Also today, reflecting on the March for Science, if climate change were a song, what would it sound like?
Playing with the gear in a music studio, sort of an alchemist with sound.
Grappling with the past and reckoning with the future, today on Cross Currents. Dozens of teenagers robbed and assaulted passengers on a BART train over the weekend in an apparently orchestrated attack, authorities said today. Witness accounts and surveillance video showed more than 40 teens jumping the fare gate at the Coliseum station Saturday night, according to a BART spokeswoman. They entered a train that pulled into the station, grabbed bags and phones from seven passengers, and then dispersed into the neighborhood before transit police could respond. Two people suffered minor facial injuries and were treated at the scene. There were no reports of weapons used in the attack. Authorities are reviewing surveillance video to try to identify suspects, and they plan to share it with local law enforcement and the school district. BART has stepped up patrols in recent weeks in response to a series of robberies, and it plans to increase police presence at some stations. Now, let's switch gears. If you've driven across the Bay Bridge this month, you probably noticed the banner above the Treasure Island Tunnel that says Armenian Genocide 1915. It's been just over a century since the Ottoman Empire began to systematically kill what would eventually be 1.5 million Armenians. Waves of refugees immigrated to the Bay Area, fleeing the killings. Today, tens of thousands of people of Armenian descent live here. And this isn't just history. The Turkish government continues to deny that the genocide happened, and the U.S. government still doesn't use the word genocide. The family of KALW's Jeremy Dalmas came to San Francisco as part of the diaspora. He brings us this story of what it means to be Armenian a century after the genocide.
So this is the first floor of our school.
This picture is that the kids made?
Those are the kids made, yes.
Principal Grace Andonian shows me Armenian sayings along with illustrations by students.
Yes. So, for example, hair started growing on my tongue, which means that I have been repeating this over and over and over and over again.
We're at KZV Armenian School in San Francisco. I am a half Armenian, and I went to elementary school in San Francisco, but I didn't go here.
Another one is put an earring on your ear, means keep it in your mind.
Remember it,
yeah.
To me, these two idioms perfectly describe what it can be like to be an Armenian American and talk about the Armenian Genocide. It is so important to remember and to commemorate it, but at the same time, it can dominate the conversation. When we talk about ourselves to the world, this is what we talk about. Stories about the genocide follow a script, and they always sound something like this.
We have come to the desert in northern Syria to look for evidence of a mass murder.
The Armenian Genocide began under the cover of World War I. By 1923, 1.5 million Armenians were dead.
To this day, Turkey denies the genocidal intent of these mass murders.
But I want to try and tell my own story. A story not about what I know, but about how I feel. I want to understand how I feel today about something that happened 100 years ago to my ancestors. My grandfather was born in Erzurum, a city that's now in eastern Turkey. When the genocide started, his family was marched out of town towards Syria. He watched his father beheaded and then was forced to walk in circles in the desert where his baby sister died because their mother couldn't nurse her. Somehow, he managed to escape westward and in the 1920s brought his family to San Francisco, where he set up a grocery shop in the Mission. I remember when I first heard the details about what happened to my grandfather. I was a kid, a few years younger than he probably was. The next day, I went on the playground and told other kids that my grandfather had watched his father murdered in front of him. And then I felt instantly guilty about it, because I was boasting. Look what makes us unique and different. I suppose it was my way of processing it. It's that tug both ways. I want to remember, but how do I talk about this? As a child, I struggled with that, and I still do now. Many Armenian Americans feel the issue will remain unresolved until Turkey recognizes what their ancestors did to ours. But do I need that acknowledgement? Maybe if I hear that denial, it will strike a nerve.
I don't know anything about it, but I want to know the truth. I think we should leave it up to the historians and let history decide.
That's an online video by a Turkish group called Let History Decide. Their message is that historians should look at the facts and decide whether or not it was a genocide, as if that hasn't been happening already for decades.
Let history decide.
Let history decide.
They show the faces of people from around the world who all repeat the same phrase.
Let history decide. Let history decide.
They're from Miami, Honduras, Maryland, and then...
Let history decide.
They show a picture of someone from Erzurum, the city my grandfather was born in. The man is looking out at me and saying everything my grandfather experienced never happened. Watching this made me hold my head in my hands and stumble across the room. It feels like this man is trying to personally attack me and is enjoying doing it. I could say that I won't be able to move on from this until the genocide is recognized by people like him, but do I have that luxury? What if they never do? And it makes me wonder how this feels for other Armenians like me. So I spend hours talking with other Armenians about it. Specifically to Armenians of my generation, around 30. How do they feel 100 years on? Hazmi Gengamian is a 32-year-old civil and human rights lawyer who lives in Oakland. She tells me April is a delicate month for her. On the 24th, the day we commemorate the genocide, she takes it especially easy.
I take the day off, and I light a candle, I pray, I burn some sage, I call in my ancestors, I remember them. Sometimes I partake in a march, sometimes I just want to be in silence, somewhere in nature. I think we're a testament to how something 100 years ago still impacts us.
33-year-old Greg Nemet feels the same way. He's lived in the Bay Area for 13 years and is involved with an Armenian fraternal organization called Knights of Vartan.
And you get people saying like, oh, 100 years, does not matter. That 100 years ago was yesterday. It's because of the burden that we carry, you know? We process constantly.
I definitely process. But do I feel burdened? As much as I am thinking about this, I still don't know what I feel. I also spoke with his sister, 28-year-old Rose Nemet.
Got hit with the Armenian activist bug right after college. It's very much part of who I am.
She talks about how it's difficult to keep explaining to non-Armenians the importance of the genocide.
I feel like it's my responsibility to do so, that I don't want to relinquish to somebody else. But on the other hand, it's like, why is the onus on me to spend all of my time doing this over and over again? It's like reliving it.
It sounds like, for her, there is that tug back and forth, but for a different reason. For her, it's too painful, whereas for me, I think I want to feel the pain. I wanted to understand more.
Why do you think that something that happened at this point 100 years ago is like affecting you today?
Yeah. Her brother answers.
Because it's so close to home. That child that was walked through the desert, that's my relative. That's my brother. That's my sister, you know?
Rose Nemet jumps back in.
Being a part of a people where your genocide is still under question, you know, still kind of up for debate, you feel like you have to state your case to everybody. Like you're accused of something. Like literally, like Tim, for me, that like goes from zero to hit you in the face, you know, in seconds.
Then she turns the question back around to me.
I'd love to hear how you feel about that. Do you still feel like you carry it with you? Maybe not as... I'm wondering if the volume is high or if it's off or...
Okay. Moment of truth. I'm obviously still talking about the genocide, but do I feel it? Maybe that's the issue. I care about it, and I think about it, but it feels distant. And I can't make myself feel things that I do not feel. Then I worry that I'm being Armenian wrong. But Greg Nemet brings me back down to earth.
So I see an Armenian person when I'm talking to you. You have as much right as that guy, or as that woman, or as anybody. That's it. End of story. That's it.
It feels good to hear him say that. Maybe that's what I needed to hear. I have definitely felt that by not being Armenian enough, I am a living symbol that the genocide was successful. I think that's something that a lot of Armenians feel. It's silly, but it's real.
I was like, oh, like, me not being Armenian, does that mean like Turkey won? Like, you know? Like...
And like, I think we're all laughing because we all have these like little checklists in our heads that say Turkey won, you know, like if they're not, you know, like if we don't hit all those bases.
So if we're struggling with this at 30, I wanted to know how an even younger generation feels. Back at the Armenian school, I meet Principal Grace Andonian.
We'll be going into the eighth grade.
Okay, boys and girls.
What did you just say to me?
We said good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon to you as well.
Me and about 15 eighth graders all sit in a circle on the floor of their class. They're all wearing their school uniforms and are excited to talk with me. This is the first generation to grow up without family members who went through the genocide. I asked the students if they've ever met any survivors. They haven't. Jennifer Kazarian answers me.
Last year, someone died, a survivor. That was the last known survivor of the Armenian genocide in the Bay Area.
They know all about the genocide. I ask a question and their hands shoot up. Eighth grader Caroline Amanian explains how she feels about people talking about the genocide.
The Armenian genocide isn't like the only Armenian, like it doesn't define Armenians. Like we have over like 3,000 years of history, and after people recognize the Armenian genocide, we can kind of move forward and have people recognize our culture, like and all that.
And that like you don't want to like be defined.
No.
By the genocide.
No, I don't think that's really right.
As I get ready to leave, they recite a poem for me, celebrating Armenian culture.
Son, tam yev varujan, yelekhnya kirchov yerketsi parket, kezi enza im hayrenik, sosyas
hadarenik. If this were your usual Armenian genocide piece, this would be where I talk about how I can't rest until the genocide is recognized by Turkey. Except for me, personally, I choose for that not to be true. I want recognition, but I don't want to wait another 100 years for Turkey to play catch up. I don't want the darkness to continue to dominate my relationship with my culture. I've done my genocide piece. Next time you tune in, it'll be a piece about this great new Armenian queer magazine I found, about me trying to discover Armenian paganism, or about my famous Armenian cousin, Cher. This will be my way of celebrating my ancestors. I'll keep the earring in my ear to remember, but I want to stop repeating this. No more hair on my tongue. For Crosscurrents, I'm Jeremy Dalmas.
To find out about events commemorating the Armenian Genocide, go to klw.org, click Crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. On Saturday, demonstrators took to streets around the world in a march for science.
Science is the systematic reduction of ignorance.
Climate change is an issue that can be hard for some to prioritize. It's abstract. We can read the charts and the statistics, but is there a way to feel it? The Bay Area's Climate Music Project at UC Berkeley wants to make that experience visceral. It's a collaboration between data science and music that tells the story of how the climate has changed in the last 200 years, what we can expect in the future, and how we can all help address what's arguably the greatest challenge facing humanity. It's being performed this Friday in San Francisco. Reporter Julie Kane has a preview.
Eric Ian Walker is a composer.
I'm sort of an alchemist with sound.
His music studio looks pretty much how you'd expect. One side's dominated by a big mixing console with all kinds of knobs and buttons and lights. Big speakers sit in the corner. A few feet away, a piano is piled with sheet music. And then there are all the scientific graphs pinned up on his wall.
So we have all these curves, right? There's sea ice, the pH of the ocean, the incoming and outgoing long wave radiation, which is actually kind of the big thing, CO2 increase, and air temperature.
The graphs show climate change, how it's projected to affect our world and how it has already. But it's all numbers and lines, plotting incremental changes over time. Walker's job is to translate this data into music, to create a composition that will let listeners feel how climate has and might change over 500 years, from 1800 to 2300, all in the course of 30 minutes.
The scientific data is very real, and I'm following it rather religiously to make it happen. But there's still the human element in it.
What he means is he's using his skills as a composer to create something people will actually want to listen to and be able to tolerate.
So this is when things are just sort of stable and not changing. But we do have the violin is weaving in and out. There's a little bit of an orchestral sound.
The violin represents humanity. In the performance, musicians will play live on stage against the backdrop of Walker's composition, the human element interacting with the ongoing changes in the background of ambient sound he's making in the studio. Walker has assigned musical properties to all those climate change graphs on his wall. So increases in air temperature change the pitch. Solar radiation distorts the notes. Higher levels of carbon dioxide speed up the tempo. As the piece progresses, he starts to let the course of climate change affect the melody. you can really start hearing changes around the year 1950. That's when CO2 levels first start to noticeably rise and the temperature begins creeping up. By the year 2000, just 50 years later, the temperature has gone up one full degree Celsius, and that's where we still are, right now. Now, 1 degree might not seem like a lot, until you hear it. By the year 2025, projections show the temperature rising another full degree, 20 years instead of 200. Climate change is starting to happen faster. Walker says this is where climate scientists are pushing for us to stay, if at all possible. To do that, we'd have to cap all carbon emissions by the year 2100. And even if we do, Walker says temperatures will still continue to rise, although more gradually. But if we don't,
so 3 degrees is like 2060. 4 degrees is 2075. 5 degrees up is 2100. I mean, that's pretty cacophonous disaster.
The cacophonous disaster hits its peak in this musical composition in the year 2300, 500 years after it starts. By that time, if we've done nothing, the project's climate researchers say the temperature will have risen by 9 degrees Celsius, which makes that pretty melody we started with sound something like this. It's hard to listen to, and that's the point. If the global temperatures really went up that much, the results would be catastrophic. But Walker wants people to be able to stay with the bigger point of the piece, that we're not there yet, that it doesn't have to be inevitable.
So periodically during this cacophony, as things get wilder and wilder, we pause and we refer back to where the world would be if we managed to hold it at 2 degrees, because that's where we kind of need to be able to hold it. That would be livable. So that gives us some a ray of hope in this.
For Cross Currents, I'm Julie Kane.
The Bay Area Climate Music Project will perform Eric Ian Walker's work as part of a show that's this Friday at No Space in San Francisco's Mission District. All the details are at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. Today's Cross Currents team includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Olivia Henry, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Kavalroop Singh, Andrew Stelzer, and Bowen Wang. The show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Liza Veal. Jen Chien is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by a band called Cocktails. Cocktails will play the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco tomorrow evening. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.
Give me a reason.